Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is September 6th, 2002. This session is Rituals for Healing Loss. Healing stories from scriptures and everyday sacredness. Dr. Nancy C. Reeves will be your presenter. REN 2002-10. Let's listen in.
Slowly going up. Oh, yes. I just saw it actually change from 62 to 63.
Oh, wow.
So yes, this is good. And I'm Nancy Reeves, and this is the last session of Found Through Loss, Healing Stories from Scripture and Everyday Sacredness. And today we're looking at ritual. Who has not come to something undone this week? So anybody who has a few people. A lot of the material that we've been doing over the week is from my three different books. One is not out yet. It's called Found Through Loss. It will be out January, and I have some flyers on it. And it will have it's a series of stories, and it will have a CD at the back. And I will be telling the stories, and Marty Helgen and Lydia Good will be singing and providing instrumentals on it. The other book is A Path Through Loss, A Guide to Writing, Healing, and Growth, and it has a lot of material we're going through, as well as a structured journal in the back for people to find their own path, to maybe open to some clarity about past losses so that they can invite God into for transformation. The third book I've been using is I'd Say Yes, God, If I Knew What You Wanted. And it's 75 stories from 11 faith traditions and 11 Christian denominations about how God leads us to making decisions in rough times and in good times. And I looked at all the elements that came up again and again with the people I talked to, and started to pull out themes and qualities we need for discernment, effective discernment, things like that. So that's that. Now, they've sold out twice in the last 2 weeks at the bookstore, and so there aren't any right now, but hopefully today the bus will bring some. I have two copies left, one of each, and so if somebody would like them, you can have them. Each day I've been starting with a prayer around loss, and today I thought, especially because it's cold and it might help to sing, I wrote this. So the words to this song, you'll recognize the tune as being Beethoven's. On my 50th birthday, I woke up early in the morning, and I was really into that whole, wow, what a change in my life now, being 50. And I was feeling grateful to God, and I was thinking about all the lost work I'd done over the years, and I was also thinking about discernment and following God's will. So these words came. So, do we need to turn the light on? Can you see that all right?
Yeah.
Okay, so people with big, strong voices are going to start. Because I don't sing on key. Hey, would you like to stand? Would that help? Okay.
We adore you, holy mystery, source of all who calls us in. Word whose words have taught and claimed us, sacred spirit dwells within. We are people loved and loving, chosen and choosing, work with you. Healing broken world as partners, peace and joy and hope renew. Life's joys.
thought that we would talk for about 40 minutes about ritual, and then I'd leave it open because I know over the week people have said we didn't have long enough for questions, and we might have, you know, anything you want to ask about grief and loss and spirituality, you know, we'll have a bit of time for it. Ritual. Ritual is a ceremony that marks a significant experience. It's an out-of-the-ordinary experience and contains deep, often sacred meaning. People are rarely neutral about ritual. I will have people who say, I went to the funeral and it was the most comforting experience. It held me and I was allowed to grieve through that. And it really gave me comfort and guidance and support. And somebody else will say, that was the most hypocritical experience I've ever been to. I'm sitting on hard chairs. I don't know what's going on. They kept calling him Fred when everybody always referred to as Frankie. Like, this was not about the person that I know. And so I started to become interested in how people could be so wildly different in their views and understandings about ritual. So in the 80s, I started to research ritual, and I ended up doing my doctoral dissertation on what elements need to be in ritual to make it helpful, to make it psychotherapeutic, particularly when people feel stuck, unresolved in their grief. And it, at that point, it was very difficult to find anything in the literature about ritual. There were lots of stories about rituals, lots of liturgies, but I couldn't find research that had been done really looking at ritual and what makes it psychotherapeutic. So I found five folk who had been stuck in their grief for one reason or another and had found that a ritual helped them move it through. In order to do that, I also had to study ritual, the normal rituals around loss and grief. And so I want to present some of that with you. Just having the intent to have a good ritual doesn't mean it's going to happen. And I want to tell you a little story. Early on, this fellow came to one of my workshops and shared his story and said, please tell people, let them learn from my experience. Pastor Bob really wanted to do a good ritual. Now this was in the 70s, late 70s, and he had just been ordained, and he had a mentor, Pastor Peter, who was in great demand for funerals. His services touched people deeply and at times increased subsequent church attendance, which is always a little plus. So Bob attended one of Peter's funerals since he realized his own lacked power. The ritual moved him and he left with the impression of masses of flowers, which gave him the sense of new life, growth, healing, and a few hymns that brought tears to his eyes, and he hadn't even known the deceased. So for his next funeral, Bob eagerly implemented these new ingredients. The immediate family were somewhat sticky about the flowers. It seems Mary had requested no arrangements. Bob thought, I guess they can't afford it. So out of his own pocket, he provided. And the church looked like a garden. The service was a powerful one for Bob. And he noticed that Mary's daughter, Deborah, went through numerous tissues. Bob's satisfaction was blunted as the mourners filed out of the church. One elderly woman complained to another. Bit of a slap in the face to Mary's memory, having all those blooms about. With her being so allergic, her own funeral would have killed her if she hadn't. The other replied, poor Debbie has hay fever as bad as her mom. Did you see the problem she was having? During the service. Bob learned from that experience. And we were talking yesterday about, about symbols and the use of those. The helping hand strikes again. Let's go down to the next one. I'm going to start to kind of explain this in more depth. A lot of people, when they say the word ritual, they're really meaning ritualized behavior. people say, oh, I have my morning ritual. You know, I get up, I need to have my cup of coffee, I need to read the paper. Okay. Does that match the definition? You know, it's out of the ordinary, contains deep, often sacred meaning. Probably not. Now, I know that, you know, the particularly the Buddhist concept of mindfulness, that you're totally present to every experience, can mean that everything can be seen as sacred. And yet, I don't think most people are looking for transformation. Well, there's certain kinds of transformation when they have the cup of coffee, but not, you know, you're not seeing it as a religious experience, probably. So that's a habit that can be helpful. We have ritualized behavior. Some people have a condition called obsessive-compulsive disorder where they have a number of ritualized behaviors that are very unhelpful. But and we look at it and we say, well, you're washing your hands, you know, 50 times a day. It helps them to contain this anxiety that they feel. So a ritualized behavior can be very helpful, but it's not a ritual. Now, a ritual is a one-time experience. You never have the same ritual twice. Otherwise, it turns into ritualized behavior. Some folks go to church as ritualized behavior. Right? They're not open to transformation. You know, they're there so because it's politically correct in their community to be there, or you know, they want everybody to see the new dress they've got, or you know, it's just a nice way to socialize, or they're bored on Sunday morning and, you know, this has got music. They're not there to give themselves, to allow God to touch them, to allow transfer. Now, some of the things God does, and it's a real wake-up call and a conversion experience, but they're not. You can go to something that is a ritual and treat it as a ritualized behavior. If you've been to Michael's talks, that's where the ego gets in there and says, you know, I'm the one in control here. I'm not going to allow God to be. But ritualized behavior can be very helpful. We can't go through, you know, all parts of our life having one ritual after another. It's too intense. So we have ritualized behaviors. Now let's move down to a little. Now, Van Gennep was an anthropologist who, at the turn of the century before last, researched a lot of communities in many parts of the world to see what kind of rituals they did and how that came about. He coined the term limen, which is the Latin word for threshold, when he talked about rituals, because he said that societies develop ritual to help people move from the threshold of one status to another. So there could be around entering the community through baptism, being part of the community in a new way through marriage or through a ritual that proves that now you are an adult, not a child any longer. And though rituals usually would be different for girls and for boys, in that rituals around death, rituals around sometimes retirement, ending a position or becoming a crone, or when a girl first starts to menstruate. And what he found was it's those times when we're making a transition from one status to another that many religions and cultures feel that there's danger, like here be dragons at that time, that we could lose ourselves or lose our soul in those times of chaos, because at some point we are not firmly in the new, but we're out of the old. So we don't have the safeguards of the old status, and we don't have the safeguards of the new. And so the culture or the religion comes together at those times and creates a very powerful ceremony to hold the person on all levels, to say to them, yes, you may be acting very different. You may even feel crazy during this time. Any of you woke up on the day you were getting married and thought, why am I doing this? Am I ready? There's often that anxiety or doubt or confusion or you know, the morning you were ordained, or I mean, you know, it could be anything, right? I certainly woke up the day after giving birth to my daughter, and of course for the last few months I was just waiting for this lump to get out of me, and you know, thought, I'm not ready to be a mother. And Bob said, isn't that a little late? it's that time where suddenly open to the chaos of this new experience. And so a ritual is developed around that time. Now let's move down a little bit. And let's go for the three. There's preliminal, liminal, and postliminal. What Van Gennep says is that that cultures and religions prepare people for this liminal experience. And so for death, the preparation may be things like the person writing a will, or making funeral arrangements, saying, I know that I'm going to die soon, or maybe gathering friends and family at the bedside. There are different religions have particular rites that are done, the anointing of the sick, or some kind of counseling or guiding process prior to the time of death, around marriage or making a committed bond to another. You may have the stag parties or the showers or other things which are supposed to inform you of what this new status is going to be like, make it seem more doable. I think sometimes it has the opposite effect. But then the actual liminal time, the transition, the death has occurred, so we need to prepare the body, clean the body, do something to honor what has happened and to acknowledge what has happened. The wake or the funeral or the memorial service. The wedding, of course, with the, or hand fasting ceremony for marriage. Then the post-liminal.
Oh, there went the bulb.
This is a transition.
This is a transition. Yes. Anybody have a ritual around the bulb going?
This is liminal.
So the post-liminal is the ritual, a ceremony that is done to show that you are now in your new status. You have successfully crossed the threshold and you have arrived in this new place. And so for the grievers, it might be sometime down the road spreading the ashes. You know, in the Japanese culture, it's done a year later to give the person that much time. In some cultures, a lot of Christian cultures, traditionally, it's been when you move out of your mourning clothes. The Coast Salish, Aboriginal people, have a potlatch. And only the family members, the direct family members, can put on this potlatch. I went to one where there were 600 people. It lasted 12 hours. We had two full course meals during this process. There was dancing, there were songs, there was all of this. And only the family were allowed to organize it. Because if the family couldn't get it together, they're not in the post-liminal place. They're still grieving. So it demonstrates to the community, who up to that point would not rely on them for fishing, for hunting, for child care, they would look after them. Then the potlatch is done, and the community says, yep, I know you can do it. I think around weddings or marriage, a post-liminal ritual is when you invite your in-laws over for dinner for the first time. You put so much effort and energy into the recipes, you know, the menu, cleaning the house, like much more than just saying, hey, why don't you come over this Friday night, and then you think about it the day before. Like, you
know. I have a ritual to discern. I found the box, but I haven't included it.
Right here. It's
great.
Yeah,
so
it's probably hot yet, too.
Oh, yeah, watch the...
Is it turned off?
Don't burn yourself. I'm a psychologist that can't stop.
Thank you.
And what the ritual, that post-liminal ritual needs, is that the in-laws come and appreciate that the young couple are now in a new status, that they're doing it. It ruins it, it undermines it, if the mother-in-law brings over an entree saying, well, I didn't know if you were going to have enough, but, right? And then you get problems through the rest of your marriage. So those rituals, you know, need to be honored.
Sure how to get it out of there.
Now, I guess we don't really need it if it's going to be. Well, it would be nice to have it.
Maybe we'll take it out of the room so we don't disturb you.
Well, let me have that overhead just so I know what I'm talking about. Okay. So any questions about that? Does that make sense that we'll have rituals to help prepare us for the transition, the actual time of transition where, you know, we could really lose ourselves or we don't know who we are, you know, and it's important then that the people within actually making that transition would look different or act different than anyone else. You know, and so it's considered very bad form if someone would wear a dress that kind of echoes the bride's, right? You know, you just think that's no. You're trying to put yourself into this role, and there's only one person that can have this role, and so that, you know, that's important. And then the post-limbal to help us to center us into the new role. Any comments or questions about that? Yeah,
I think that churches struggle to do the post-limbal.
Yes.
Much more. I mean, we have pre-communion,
yes,
pre-baptism, pre-marriage counseling, but
yes,
then what happens
afterwards?
There's that. I think that's something really weak in
exactly
all levels of our life.
Exactly. We kind of just throw people out to,
yeah,
do it on their own.
Now you're baptized, so hopefully you come to church.
Yeah.
Now you're confirmed. See?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and if all that emphasis on the pre
getting
and then
in
the actual
right
transition, and then after, a lot of people, it's a letdown.
Right. New members, you just disappear after a month or two.
That's right. In fact, it's interesting when I do a lot of workshops in hospitals and hospices, and one big issue is often when, say, a long-term patient dies, like Mrs. Smith has died, and the staff say they feel really hanging, you know, afterwards, because they still think about her, they start walking into the room to see how she's doing, and then have to realize, no, she's not there anymore. And so I suggest some post-liminal things to do, that for a while, when you do rounds and you talk about every patient that's there, include her name. Now, Mrs. Smith died 2 days ago. How are we with that? And even spending like 2 minutes with somebody saying, oh, I had a dream about her last night, or, you know, I hope she's at peace now, that last few days were so rough. Or that can really help the staff make the transition. Also, I suggest writing, having somebody who was there at the time of death or just after, to write that. Because staff can come on a week later or 2 weeks later from holiday, or it's the first time they're on shift. And where's Mrs. Smith? Oh, she died last week. How was her death? Gee, I don't know. I wasn't there. You know, and to say, there's something you can read. Someone who was present. I think it allows us to do that closure much more easily. That's why, I don't know, those of you who were here last week when we had a member of our community, Doug, who disappeared into the woods. We don't know if he's alive somewhere or if he's dead. And we were looking at what could be done, because some people didn't know him, some people knew him well. I suggested putting up sheets for each day of the search, and that anybody who wished to could write a poem or a blessing or a prayer or just what it was like for them that day when they first heard, if they were part of the search, what they did. And then that was read at Vespers on Monday night. And for many people, that was closure, that they had a chance to name it, that their feelings, their concerns.
Yeah. Obviously, the three stages are going to be affected by very sudden deaths, unexpected.
Yes,
so when you don't have the preliminary, that's going to make a difference in the aftermath.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is such a good point, because in a few minutes, hopefully, that's working again, when we talk about what elements need to be in ritual to make it helpful, we need to take those into account. And some of the most unhelpful rituals I've been to is where the person who is facilitating it is in a different place than most of the grievers the main grievers. In one case, this couple who had a baby die had known 3 months prior to the baby's birth and death that the baby would probably die. They did a lot of preparatory grieving. Now, you can't grieve for the loss until a loss occurs, but you can do a lot of grieving about some of the implications and meanings of that. But to the minister, it was a shock. Minister hadn't been part of that process. So during the service, he kept bringing up what a shock it is when a young life is snuffed out so quickly. And the couple said that just, it didn't honor where they were. You know, they said, it's not a shock to us. No, we want permission to start doing some post-liminal stuff now. We want permission to start moving past this. And he's saying, you got to open to your pain, you got to open to the grief, you got to let the grieving process happen, which would be very, very appropriate for the liminal place, but not for the place they were wanting to move to now. So keeping that in mind, otherwise you can have, and it's not that someone necessarily will always be right on where everybody in the congregation is. But one thing I found in my research was that it's important to offer some elements of the past and the present and the future, to give that sense of movement. And through that, it can comfort those people who are in the different liminal places, if we kind of honor that. Any questions or comments?
You just mentioned, I can't reconstruct the sentence, but something about you can't experience the loss till the loss occurs.
Yeah. Well, okay, we can't grieve for the fact that a loss has occurred until it occurs.
Can't you grieve for the fact that it is going to occur?
Yeah, absolutely. You see, that's the thing. But people are always shocked. They say, I thought I did all my grieving before. My husband had Alzheimer's, you know, it was for so long. I thought he was, thank you, was going to die. And so it shocks them when he does finally die that there's some grief, there's some pain.
But not necessarily so.
Not necessarily. No, may not be. But just to give people permission and to know that, you know, some implications we cannot grieve for, you know, well, until they're there later. Yeah. Great, you got it.
We got it.
I just got it. Thank you. Okay, we're going to go to the next sheet now. See how this community just pulls together? Okay. If a ritual is done well, these are some of the benefits. I'm going to go over them in a minute. What I'm going to do first is tell you about a ritual that I studied as part of my research. It was a woman that came to me, the very first woman I ever worked with, 1985, who had a traumatic brain injury. And the neuropsychologist phoned me up from the rehab hospital, and she said, I'd like to refer Claire to you. She's had a traumatic brain injury. She's lost an eye. She's... one of her legs, I don't think will ever really support her again. She's had many other orthopedic injuries. I said, I've had no training in working with in neuropsychology. She said, good. because what I'm wanting is someone who's just going to come fresh to her, hearing her grief, hearing her loss, and help her with that. She's a human being who's in great pain. She has concrete, rigid thinking. And that's what's making it difficult right now. Because Claire was in an accident where her mother was killed, her dad was driving, didn't get a scratch. So there's all sorts of guilt issues on his part. It was his fault that the accident occurred. Her mom was killed and she was severely injured. She was in a coma for 3 weeks after the accident, so she missed her mother's funeral. In her concrete, rigid thinking, she says, I'm Catholic. And in the Catholic Church, unless you've been to the funeral, you can't acknowledge the reality that someone has died. Funerals do that. And we can't have another funeral, so I can't acknowledge that my mother has died. And the psychologist said, so what she's doing is refusing rehab. She won't admit to the reality of her injuries, because that would be admitting to the accident. She says, it's so strange, I don't know what to do with her. So Claire came to see me, and we built rapport over a few sessions, and then I said to her, what would allow you to recognize that you've been in an accident and severely injured and that your mother has died? She said, going to the funeral. I can't go to the funeral. I said, what if you could do another ritual? Oh, that would help, she said, but it's not possible because there's only one funeral. Now this is, remember, very concrete thinking. And she's, of course, misinterpreting the church doctrine, for sure. So I said, if it were possible, it would feel better. Yes, but it can't be. I said, okay, well then my job as a psychologist is to help you deal with the pain of this stuck place. What I'd like you to do as homework is to go to your parish priest and to go to your father and say to them, this is the situation I'm in. I'm not able to move forward because I wasn't at the funeral, and yet I can't have a funeral because it won't fit in the church. And she said about her dad wouldn't want another ritual. He'd already been through one. It would be upsetting. I said, and what I'd like you to do is to write down what they say about that, and I will help you grieve it. So off she went, came back the next session, said, I don't think I'll be able to continue in psychotherapy for a bit. I'm going to be too busy helping prepare for the memorial mass. Oh, I said. How did that happen? She says, I went to Father Jean, and I told him what you said, and then I had to write down his answer, and he says, the church has a wonderful provision for this. We have a memorial mass, and, you know, oh, wow, she said. And then I talked to my own dad, and he said, I was so scared you were going to die during your mom's funeral. You were still in a coma that I was hardly present to it. A mass would be just wonderful for me. And so she said, so I went back to Father Jean, and I said, when are we going to do it? And Father Jean said, well, you need to be very active in helping select the readings and inviting people, and maybe you want to have a reception afterwards. She said, oh, goodness, I don't know if I could do that. He says, no, because it's hard for you to think clearly now. She said, yes. He says, I wonder where you could learn how to think more clearly. She says, well, you know, the Gorge Road Hospital, their rehab program, they say they would like to work with me on my head injury, and maybe I could go back there. And that's a good idea, he said. And so why don't we wait, 3 months or so, and you go into the Gorge program and work with them, and then when you feel ready, we'll be able to do this. So she said, so I contacted the neuropsychologist, and I said, oh, I want to come back in the program, and I'm going to work hard, and it was, so I can't do psychotherapy. I said, fine. So off she went. She came back to see me once, just before. She had an issue she wanted to talk about. The planning was coming along really well, and she'd done really hard work in the Gorge Hospital. The actual ceremony, 40 people came to the mass, and then all came back afterwards for the reception. And she told me later when she saw me, I thought that having a head injury meant that I'd be worthless from now on. Anybody who could help put together something so sacred, so impactful, must have something going for her. So I'm going to continue with the Gorge program. I'm going to continue to be the best I can be, and I know God is so with me in this. So I saw her a few more times, and then I got a letter from her a couple of years later. She had finished the Gorge program and entered a program at Malaspina College to be an early childhood educator with preschool kids. And she was working in a special needs preschool. And she wrote to tell me that one of the little guys had said, I love my teacher. She only has one eye, and she walks funny, and she doesn't make sense sometimes when she talks. But I love her. And she said, I really feel I'm a role model for these children. A couple of years later, I got the invitation to her wedding. And a couple of years later, I got pictures of her brand new baby boy. And I thought, how wonderful that she could allow the healing. That's where we talked on the first day about cure is different than healing. God offers us healing. And she was healed. So then when we look at the benefits of ritual with Claire's story in mind, it definitely legitimized the grief. And it often, going to a ritual, shows that there are different ways of grieving. You know, so I may think it's not okay to cry, and then I see other people crying. Oh, okay. Or I'm not grieving like my mom and dad are, but I suddenly realize that I'm grieving quite like my aunt. Maybe I'll go and talk to her about how she grieves. So it gives that sense that there's other ways. It also can provide structure and stability during a time of chaos and instability, a time where we think that our whole world has fallen apart. The structure, the containment is there in a way that allows expression of feeling. It often, like with Claire, can raise self-esteem. If people go to a ritual that really touches them deeply, they feel much more connected with themselves, others, and God. And they feel like their being there has been important, they have impacted on their environment, they've done a good thing. And it can really help at a time when, again, we feel really shaky. In that structure, it often provides safety for the expression of emotion. Many people say, it's hard for me to cry, or it's hard for me to let the feelings come. But during the ritual, everyone else is doing it too. So it's okay. And I know it's time limited, it's going to end, and then we're going to go to the reception, and I'll be able to move away from some of those feelings. Or I'll be able to go home or work, whatever. It is a potent honoring of the person or the situation, the thing that we're grieving for. We put more attention and preliminarily even, you know, preparing for the ritual, thinking what we're deciding what we're going to wear. Symbols are very important, and we're going to talk about those in a minute. But one young fellow phoned me up and he said, my friend George has died. Now, George and I were members of the Sierra Club. We only ever met when we were out on hikes. And I got to know him, you know, quite deeply just by doing that. And I shared a lot about myself. But I really didn't know much about the rest of his life. I want to go to the funeral. And I would like to honor him by wearing my hiking clothes. Because that's the clothes that I wore when I was in contact with him. It would seem very strange to be dressed in a different way. And yet I'm afraid the family and friends are going to think that I'm mocking them, that I'm just, you know, coming here quickly and then I'm going to go off on a hike. And what should I do? And I said, phone someone in the family and let them know the reason. And let the grapevine we talked about yesterday work. And so he said there actually is a number in the paper, in the obituaries, and I'll phone that. So he did. And so many people came up to him and said, your being here in those hiking clothes reminds us of how passionate George was about the environment, how important it was for him to get out frequently, how he really connected with God often in the wilderness. And none of the rest of us hike, so we probably wouldn't remember that part of him, except you're such a visible representation of it. And so it really helped them to have that there. Often children will come up with symbols that, because they have relationships different than we do with people. And some of the most potent, touching experiences are things that kids have said need to be part of the ritual. Being in a ritual very frequently clarifies issues which will encourage healing and growth. I might, for example, as I'm sitting there feeling sad that my mom, you know, has died, all of a sudden feel a surge of anger come up. I think, I don't want to feel this. But if I can allow it, I will realize something maybe that I need to give to God. You know, or just talk to her in my mind about it. There's an interesting, which I don't suggest here, but interesting ritual done in one of the South Seas Islands. I read an anthropologist who did a study on it. Small community, there wouldn't be more than about 50 people living on this island. When someone dies, they tie them into a chair, sitting upright in the middle of the village square, and they form a circle. And they have prayers, they honor the person, and then they start walking around, and what you need to do is say something to the person about a resentment you had, or a problem you had with them, or something you appreciated about them. And the village wise person won't let the circle, the people leave the circle until they know that everything's been aired and that everybody knows it, so that everybody can help after with this. And so if some person is holding a grudge that they're not willing to speak, the circle keeps going around, and that person's confronted with this body. And then finally they say, 10 years ago, you! So, interesting ritual. But often issues that we don't realize are there can be clarified. It may be even issues around what we need to help us. I might realize, this person really was my best friend. And who is going to be there in that way for me now? By holding that then in my heart, I can let God start to get in to help with the healing. Often too, as with Claire, can invite a sense of life direction and meaning. So many people at a funeral or memorial service will come into counseling afterwards, which is good for psychologists, saying, you know, it was a wake-up call. I realized my own mortality. I realized that, you know, if someone my age could die, I could die, and I need to do some work on myself, or I need to have life mean something more. I work a lot with communities who are in trauma after a sudden accident or some violence of some kind. And after one Claremont school had a terrible tragedy when a ski bus crashed and two of the kids were killed. Everyone on the bus was injured, some very severely. And I worked with a number of those kids for years because some of their court cases didn't come up for 5 years down the road. And it was really interesting to see the progression, the growth in compassion and empathy and concern for justice, how their faith really grew during that time. And that was in the early 80s. I've met some of them now on the street, or they've called me saying, I now work for social justice committee in my church, or I'm now, and I wouldn't have done that before. That was so important to me as an experience. Not just the deaths, but the fact that the bus company, who had kind of faked the pass of the bus.
The maintenance records.
Yeah, the maintenance records. The injustice issues and how long it dragged out in court. And they had a choice, of course. They could have turned bitter with that and pulled in and just, you know, watched their own back. Or they could allow God to transform that. And so many of them did. And reached out. It was interesting. We had something that many of them did see as a ritual. It had happened in January, and in BC, government exams, provincial exams happen very shortly after that, the end of January, beginning of February. And so many of these grade 12 students were saying, we need to be loyal to the memory of our friends and stay grieving. But if we're grieving, we can't think clearly. We can't remember well. We're not going to do well on our exams. You know, so they're between a rock and a hard place. And I worked with a lot of them, and other adults came in and were working with them. And I realized they needed something to honor their friends, but also let the grief go for a bit while they focused on their exams, which were so important to them. So we thought about what kind of ritual would be meaningful to them. And we offered some noon hour sessions in study skills for times of crisis. We had essentially the whole school, the staff as well as the kids came to these things. And it was just normal old study skills, but we did it in a very kind of solemn way. And, you know, the high priestess, who was the learning assistance teacher, did a wonderful job at, you know, kind of teaching this and facilitating it. I gave some information about grieving, and I said, loyalty to friends is so important. And also, you know, your own future is important, and your friends would want you to do well. So if you will take your grief and maybe see it as a symbol or write it down, and then put it in some container, that seems important to you, symbolic of the concern and love you have for your friend, then whenever you have thoughts about your grieving, you say, no, stop, go away, go back into the container. The container will hold you until the exams are done. And then you take out that sheet of paper, you take out that symbol, and you allow the grief again. And it was so interesting how the kids could really get into that. They would have, you know, one had a jewelry box, and she wrote it down. She put it in her jewelry box. Then they made an agreement to study together, to be community for each other. They then had pizza parties after the last exam where they would open their jewelry boxes or open this where they'd put the paper in and open to the pain again. So that by honoring it, by putting it aside, some kids went to church, gave something to their pastor. You know, we've written this about our friends. Would you hold it for us until we come and get it after our exams? So it seemed to help a lot of them. And in fact, in my Path Through Loss, I have a thought stopping sheet where I have questions people can fill out that they can then find a container and put those in order to stop these worry thoughts that won't go away, that really hurt us. 8 years later, I was sent the statistics for provincial exams for that year. And I thought, even with all the help that they'd been given from me and other people, that it would show that Claremont had slipped in the ratings. Claremont was usually very high in the ratings. And what I found was there was absolutely no statistical difference at all. Now, I know some students did much worse. You know, they were still in hospital, they were just still on drugs. But obviously, some students had done better than they would have done. And I think that's where we can be found through loss. You know, because it's not that we say, I hope a loss happens so that I can grow. But that we can, by entering into the experience and particularly finding rituals that really support and honor the grief, we can be open to the healing that God offers us. And so a number of those students did.
Excuse me, in our Bible study this week, Erlander uses this wonderful phrase, where there's a wilderness, there's a school. Right. And usually most of us kind of resist walking into the wilderness because it's so barren.
That's right.
Hard,
yes.
In the transition time, but to know that there's a school, there's an opportunity to learn and grow.
Yes.
It strikes me that that's a refrain we've been using in our Bible study this week that applies to this.
Yes. And so often, too, what you've been helping us with through the week is that when we start getting complacent in our place that we don't like, but it's familiar, you know, at least we're fed in Egypt. That's when God raises up a prophet who shakes us out of that place. And at first it feels really rough, and then we see the freedom. So that's where a good ritual gives us the sense of community. Interesting that in the research that I did, some people said they did their ritual on their own. No people. Okay. Except that I told my best friend I was doing it and asked her to pray for me. And I went and I told my family afterwards about it. It seemed very important to tell them. So community might not actually be there during the time of the ritual, but they're there preliminarily or postliminally. I've always found there's that sense of community in a good ritual because God is so passionate about communion. There's always those interconnections that a good ritual does make us feel more connected to self, other, and God. And so the sense of community as a supporter or a witness or an includer. At a time where we feel a chaos of our pain and we think, no one's ever experienced anything like this. I feel so alone. People at the ritual start sharing their own experiences. They're one of the oldest rituals that I found in the literature was about a woman named Kisa Godami. And she was born in India, very low caste. She was married above her caste and socioeconomic status, but was an object of derision and ridicule to her in-laws. Then she gave birth to a son, and then she was accepted. This was wonderful that she was blessed with a son. And when he was about 3, he died of an illness very suddenly. Now this was devastating for Kisa. What made it intolerable was her awareness that she would now go back to that low caste, you know, status. She would, you know, can't even keep a child alive. So when that happens, sometimes we just cannot admit to the reality. And earlier this week, we talked about Elijah and Elisha and how Elijah was grief therapist for Elisha to help him accept the reality that this master of his was going to die, so that he could accept the prophetship, the mantle of power that God had for him. So Kisa carried her dead child and went from person to person saying, "Have you medicine that can help my child who's ill?" And everyone said, "He's not ill, he's dead. Take him to the public cremation grounds, let him go. I can't, he's not dead, he's just sleeping." One man finally said, "I know someone who can help, a healer, a therapist, someone who has been teaching in our community under the tree, corner of the village, edge of the village." And it was the Compassionate Buddha. She went up to the Buddha and she said to him, "I'm told you can give me medicine for my son who is ill." And he looked at her and he looked at her son and he said, "Yes, I can give you medicine for healing. But you need to bring one of the ingredients to me." "Anything," she said, "anything to help my boy." He said, "I need a tiny grain of mustard seed." "Oh, I have hundreds." "It has to come from someone else, be given freely." "Well, it won't take me more than a few minutes." "It has to be from a home that has never known death. There's been no loss in that home." "Well, that might take a little longer, but I'll be back soon." And she went and she knocked on the first door, and the woman who opened heard the story that the Buddha is going to make a medicine to cure my son. "If only I could have one tiny grain of mustard seed." She said, "Oh, I could give you many. Thank you." And as the woman was turning away, Kisa said, "But there's been no loss in this house. There's been no death here, has there?" And the woman turned back and started talking about her brother. She went to the next one. Lo and behold, there had been another loss. Went to the next one and the next one and the next one. And finally, she realized that death is universal, that everyone struggles and some people have harder time than others. And she knew her son was dead. So she went to the public cremation grounds and let his body go and went back to the Buddha. And when he saw her coming, tilted his head, inquiry, and she said, "Your medicine has done its job." Wonderful,
Rachel. I'm not sure, Nancy, if this enters in here or not, but there's a group of people I think that we really need to help, and that's elderly people who are not married.
Yes, yes.
And we went to an elder hostel, and there's a friend of mine, and we had a couple in between, and we're both pastors, and they were living, they thought, in a state of sin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they started to talk about this, and they said they were really embarrassed because they were church people. Mm-hmm. And I said, and they said their family had asked them to get married, and why are you telling us to marry when you're not married now? And I said, "You know, you could be married." And they said, "What?" And I said, "Yeah, pastors act as a legal agent of the state and also as an agent of the church. Can you get legality out and become married?" They said, "You're kidding." I said, "No, I'm not kidding." They started to plan their wedding right there at the elder hostel. And I started to get scared of that. And I said, because you've mentioned your family, maybe shouldn't the family be there? And they said, well, yeah, they should be. And so we suddenly, this barrier, we were kind of at one with each other. And the most wonderful thing was, X number of months later, we got a letter from them with their picture having been married. And you know, there are a lot of reasons out there, but they didn't understand that was a possibility. Here you've got a whole community saying, we will support you. No one knows that this is possible.
That's right. Isn't that wonderful? And that's, I mean, and that's exactly what Jesus kept doing. You know, what are your needs? And opening it, you know. I mean, what I like John Shea, Christian storyteller, who says that people's judgment is usually for shame. You know, restricting, putting you down. Where God's judgment is always for possibilities. What we can open. Remember the woman at the well that Jesus met, and what did he say about her marital status?
five times, and the fellow now
is the fellow you're married to is not your husband. And did he then say, "Go marry him"?
No.
He didn't seem to be interested in that. Interesting how, you know, he was always taking the marginalized and including them, bringing them into community, but not saying, okay, I'll forgive you, or I'll let you come in here, I'll heal you, if you go and get married. And yet there are many people who long for that, and then you come along and you open that up and they can step into it. It's great if we can be Christ's hands on it.
Sure, they were. She asked about, you know, you can be married in the church.
Yeah, you can be.
Invite all your friends and family, and they have a reception and dance afterward.
Just like the Claire who had missed.
But not legally. There's no license or anything else. But it's all, it can all be.
And it's done
very beautifully.
Yeah, that's neat. Thank you.
And if you can't find a pastor to do that, come to Hudson, Wisconsin.
A good ritual promotes congruency in body, mind, emotions, and spirit. So many people who come to me just after a loss has occurred are so fragmented. No, and a ritual really gets them moving together. And they because it's something you do rather than just talk about, you know, coming to see me for psychotherapy, it's a talk therapy. But to actually have my body moving, doing something, it brings all of me together for maybe the first time in a long time. That can be helpful. There's a few more. Motivation, making a public statement about my loss. You know, this loss has impacted on me, or this is how it impacts on me, can be a wonderful motivator to continue growing. One of the rituals that I studied was a couple, a mom and her daughter, and her daughter was 20. They had lived together as a family until her late, well, I think it was probably 9 or 10 years old, and then the couple had split. Dad had moved to another community. She lived with her mom until she was a young teen. Then she wanted to go and live with her dad, who lived in a big city, and it was kind of more exciting. She was now at 20, moving back with mom. She was working as a waitress and making more in tips than mom, who was a mental health professional, was making. And there were a lot of issues about her coming back. Mom wanted her to have a curfew. She said, I'm 20, I can do what I want. Clash, clash, clash. You know, one moment I'm an adult, but the next moment, oh, didn't you wash my shirt? I need my shirt for... So, mom suggested they go into counseling. The daughter said, no way, you know, often, you know, parents, children of counselors don't want to go near it. The pastors never have issues with that. And so, mom thought, well, something needs to be done to allow us to change our relationship. So, she suggested a ritual. She said to her daughter, let's have a party. And let's bring to that party our friends and family to witness a contract that we will draw up of our rights and ordered responsibilities to each other now as mother and daughter in this new way of being together. Her daughter thought that was great. Party was a good word. They decided that they wanted to have a lot of decadent desserts at this party, but neither of them wanted to provide the money. So then the mom said, actually, I think there's a purification rite that our society has quite a lot. It's called the garage sale. Why don't we have a garage sale? And with the proceeds from it, we'll use those for the desserts. Donner thought that was great. They ended up doing essentially what psychologists call a life review, because they said they picked up every single object in the house and said, do you want this? Should we sell it? Mom said she picked up something her daughter had bought with, you know, probably 35 cents when she was, you know, 7, and said, well, I know you really want to keep this. She said, oh, I've always hated it. Oh. Mom said, well, yeah, actually, I could let it go. Many things they learned about each other doing that. So you see, the preliminal already was bringing them together, was starting the transformation process. They then had the ritual where they talked about the rights and responsibilities. They gave each other a gift that they found, and they both chose shells for the complex and beautiful relationship that they were wishing for. They had some prayers, they had everyone sitting around in a circle, and they had a candle go from person to person with a wish, a blessing, a prayer. And then they had dancing. And she said that really showed the difference, because the young people, you know, danced for hours, and the older people did one or two dances and then sat down and chatted. And you could start to see how different the generations were, and yet they were there together. And so a wonderful ritual. She said it was so sacred. Then, she said, about 3 months later, her daughter moved out. And her initial response is, we did that for nothing. What she realized that over the next few weeks is that she moved in with two other girls. And as a roommate, she was respectful of their boundaries. She was very mature in taking responsibility for her part of things, which she'd never been before, cleaning her room and the meals, was quite assertive at getting her own needs met, and it seemed that the ritual had really shown her she could be an adult in this responsible way. So, you know, that's not done in a church, that's not done anywhere we would see maybe as sacred, and yet she said it had such a deep sense of life's meaning and sacredness to doing that. Next, we get to elements needed for effective ritual, which I'm going to do real fast because I know we need to stop. We've already talked about some of these. For a ritual to be psychotherapeutic, for it to be healing, for it to open people to transformation, and this is all in my book, A Path Through Loss, too, we need to be really clear on what the goal is. I did a workshop for mental health professionals, and before I even started, this psychiatrist said to me, I knew you were coming to speak on this topic, so I have never done it before, but I got one of my patients to go out and do a ritual, and it really didn't help her. Great, what did you do? He said, I had her go out to her mother's grave and tell her mother what she really thought of her. And she's been carrying a lot of anger. I said, is that the issue you've been working on in therapy? He says, no, but, you know, I needed to do the ritual around something. I said, you got to go with where the energy is. Like, what, did she need a ritual? I don't do one just because, I think I'll do a ritual. You know, it's getting boring. You know, there needs to be a place where the person really needs to be held in that kind of sacred container, and you know, you gotta have a reason for it. And it really needs to match what the issue is. So the goal needs to be clarified. It needs to be personalized. We talked yesterday about symbols. It needs to have symbols that fit for the individual. One person will say, I need this particular kind of music there because that's what I associate with the person who's died. Somebody else might say, color is really important to me, or texture. Yeah.
A few years ago when I was out here, I got radio communication with a dear friend and I was trying to deal with it. that night at Vespers, they sang some gospel songs. This guy had sang in a quartet, and that did it for me.
Yeah, that really.
The music was very.
It grounded you, probably. It opened you to the healing.
Mm-hmm.
Let you cry.
Yeah,
gave permission. And that's where, so I have a checklist in my book where I say, you know, what kind of music is important to you when you think about this particular thing? What colors, what actions, what participation seem to be really important too. If I just go and attend, it's not going to be transformative for me. I need to really enter into it. That doesn't mean that everybody has to get up and speak. But just that guy wearing his clothes, his hiking clothes, made him present to the experience, opened the transformation. We need to, as we talked about, keep in mind where people are. Is it still preliminal for them? Is it liminal? Sometimes someone who is disappeared, we don't know if they've run away, they don't know if they've been kidnapped or killed or what. We can't do a ritual around their death, we don't know they've died. People are still in a preliminal place, but we can do a ritual that supports the uncertainty, the worry, that helps us pray as a community. We can do a ritual for that. But it would be very invasive for whoever was coordinating it to come in and say, well, we'll just have to admit they're dead. It's been, you know, a week now, they're dead. No, not necessarily. Careful preparation, as I showed with this couple. A lot of the benefit of the ritual actually occurred prior. As they did the garage sale, as they really thought about it, they did a lot of journaling, you know, those kinds of things. And then lastly, to have a sense of the flow here, that we're not stuck in one space or time. So elements of the past, that's where tradition can be so important, to have some elements of tradition there. Also, something that speaks to us right now, where we are, and then something that helps us, gives us comfort, guidance, support for the future, that the community will be there, that God will be there, that we can build on the past and we can build on the present to move into the future with more hope and trust. And so doing those things gives more opportunity for people to receive the healing and the growth they need. And I said I was going to stop early, and I'm sorry, but any comments or questions? And though it's 10:02, if some of you would like to go and get ready for lunch, dude, I'll stay around till noon. And I do have one of each of these if anybody would like them. So any comments or questions?
Right here.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Well, my husband died 2 years ago, a minister, and three couples of favorites of ours were gathered around the bed as he died. We could see the monitor up there. And I know he knew we were there.
Yes.
Subconscious.
Yes.
And he began to sing hymns softly.
Right.
And he did some of Milk's favorites. And every time I get a little boom, I just think of those supportive friends.
Right.
Now they've carried me into the church.
How that community was there and supported, and that's wonderful. Yeah. The community can do so much in that way. And to honor, right? But music is so potent, so powerful.
This is your last session.
This is my last session.
Thank you very much.